Hi, I'm Quinn Warnick from St. Edward's University, and I'm here to find out how many presentations you can sit through about Metafilter. we'll ask you to sign the IRB forms on the way out the door. You're all part of our secret study. Today I want to talk about three definitions, one website, I bet you can guess which one, four paradoxes that can help us understand a single troubled word, and that's this Greek word, which has come to us in English as the word ethos or ethos or athos, right? Several different pronunciations. Again, we all come back to that problem. It's a popular word that has lost its definition. So we have common definitions in popular culture today that come something like essence or credibility or personality. In addition, there's a whole set of academic definitions such as customs or places or habits. But really, when we teach the concept of ethos to undergraduate students, we often trace it back to Aristotle's rhetoric. Our students, of course, and sometimes us too, ignore what Aristotle actually says. Here's what he says. Persuasion is achieved by the speaker's personal character when the speech is so spoken as to make us think him credible. This kind of persuasion, like the others, should be achieved by what the speaker says, not by what people think of this character before he begins to speak. So we teach this, and then we immediately throw that out the window, and we start talking about what we know of the speaker. All right, who said this, and what do we know about their background and their credibility? So our students may have good reason for throwing out this definition, given how simplistic it is. Let's consider three different notions of ethos. So the first one is from Isocrates. The man who wishes to persuade people will not be negligent as to the matter of character. No, on the contrary, he will apply himself above all to establish a most honorable name among his fellow citizens. For who does not know that words carry greater conviction when spoken by men of good repute than when spoken by men who live under a cloud, and that the argument which is made by a man's life is more weight than that which is furnished by words? Note that the emphasis here rests on the actions, not the words of the speaker. Isocrates makes it clear that the efficacy of a speaker's words will be greater if the speaker is of good repute. Although Isocrates predates Aristotle, his ideas find their greatest proponents in Rome several centuries later. And here's Quintilian, who says, "All this species of eloquence, however, requires the speaker to be a man of good character and of pleasing manners. The virtues which he ought to praise, if possible, in his client, he should possess or be thought to possess himself. Thus he will be a great support to the causes that he undertakes, to which he will bring credit by his own excellent qualities. But he who, while he speaks, is thought a bad man, must certainly speak ineffectively, for he will not be thought to speak sincerely. If he did, his ethos or character would appear." Quintilian argues that orators must not only speak well, but act well. The good man, whose argument will be bolstered by his own excellent qualities. And this gives rise to the notion of the vir bonus, or the good man speaking well. But then along comes the internet and kills the weird bonus, right? So we're back to square one on that. Let's look at a second definition. Maybe Aristotle was right after all, and maybe ethos is generated by what the speaker says. Here's Michael Hyde, who says, "Aristotle directs our attention away from an understanding of ethos as a person's well-lived existence and toward an understanding of ethos as an artistic accomplishment. For Aristotle, the pisteis or proofs are elements of the text, and their effectiveness depends on the careful construction of the speech, not on the personal attributes of the speaker." So in this definition, ethos becomes a textual element. It's internal to the discourse itself. But there's a third definition that we shouldn't forget. Thomas W. Benson claims that Aristotle's notion of ethos as a mode of proof presupposes earlier concepts of ethos as dwelling place. And here, S. Michael Halloran argues that ethos is a collective, not an individual attribute. So he says that the root really can be traced back to people gathering together in a public place, sharing experiences and ideas. It's this notion of gathering place. So why does this third definition of ethos as gathering place matter? Well, it's because what online communities have become, and our case in point obviously today is the site of Metafilter, and specifically MetaTalk. My dissertation, which I completed last year, it was a year-long ethnographic study which combined several different methods and approaches for studying specifically MetaTalk and looking at the subsection of the site where members go to hash out problems, report bugs, request features, and argue and debate about everything from the pronunciation of the site itself to how users are treating one another. So analogies that members used to describe the site in my survey. It's like the core members of the debate team getting together after a meet in a bar somewhere to hash out what they did well, what they did poorly, what they have responded, why they responded in a particular manner, and to accuse their teammates of unsportsmanlike conduct at the event. Someone else says MetaTalk is a place where you can walk around without your pants. A little less eloquent than the first one, perhaps, but interesting. Someone else calls it the police blotter of the site. Another one calls it the lunch table at work. People aren't fully removed from the business of things, but they're a little less inhibited. And then I like this one. MetaTalk is kind of a, like the back alley behind the bar where people go outside, go after the bouncers, tell them to take it outside. It's much dirtier and more personal. And then this last one warmed the rhetorician's heart in me. It's someone called it sort of a gathering place, which lines up with Michael Halloran's and Thomas Benson's ideas of ethos. So for a year, I studied MetaFilter, and more specifically, MetaTalk, and I could show you pretty charts that break down the 43,037 posts and 1,043,854 comments made by the 14,861 users. We could talk about how MetaTalk posts are categorized on the site, or the average number of comments per post, or even the average length of comments. I could talk about the long tail effect and how it relates to user participation. This is a graph showing all users who made more than 100 comments in MetaTalk, and that very tiny thin line that's twice as high as the next one is our good friend Cortex over there. and next is Jessamine, one of the other moderators. Or I could talk about the varying levels of moderator participation on MetaFilter subsites and how they have a much stronger presence in MetaTalk than they do in MetaFilter or Ask MetaFilter. But given how much data we've looked at today and how many statistics we've discussed, I think I'd rather tell you a story about Svetlana and Ksenia, two Russian students who came to the United States for what they thought were summer jobs. And this is a story that came about just as I was ending my my study of MetaTalk and MetaFilter. So this is a post that appears on May 19th, 2010 in Ask MetaFilter, and posted by a user who goes by the name of Fake, appropriately enough for our discussions today about anonymity. Daniel Reince is the user behind Fake, and he's a 28-year-old North Dakota blogger who was traveling at this time to California for to interview for a new job or to start a new job. And so he's posting this kind of on the fly, and here's what he says in case you can't read it on the screen. A Russian friend of mine may be in a dangerous situation in Washington, D.C. My friend and former student Kay arrived in D.C. yesterday along with a friend. She came over on some kind of travel exchange program put together by a Russian travel agency called, and it's since been obscured here. They paid about $3,000 for this program. The program promised a job offer in advance but didn't deliver. They said they would send one via email but failed there too. Her contact in the USA barely speaks English, doesn't answer her calls but does answer mine. He has asked her and her friends to meet in New York City tonight around midnight with promises of hostess work in a lounge. Yes, I know how horrific that sounds. That's why I'm working all possible angles here. She is not going to New York City, but I need some help handling and understanding how to handle this. I have a friend helping them with cheap hotel for the night, but that's all at the moment. I'm presently driving to LA and could fly her and her friend to meet me there on Saturday, but couldn't house them indefinitely. I'll be monitoring this thread over the next hour. And you'll notice so this was posted at 3:09 p.m. and 5 minutes later, someone comes in and says she should probably contact her consulate. And then he responds, as in the Russian consulate, and then another person has gone and looked up the information for them. And so all within 8 minutes of the post, we now have contact information being provided to this guy who's traveling and can't handle the situation on his own. As the thread goes along, someone else chimes in, I live in D.C., let me know if you need any help from somewhere here. I don't really know about human trafficking scams or anything like that, but if I can help in any way, email me. And immediately we begin to see this this idea of communal gathering place, this place that provides help and support and safety for other members of the site, and even friends of friends, starts to emerge. Someone else comes in, I live in D.C., and someone just quotes the previous one and says, seconded. In other words, another offer of help. Fake responds, the problem is that I can't convince her or them, so I'm trying to find some other means of protection or prevention. I'm really desperate here. The place they've been promised a job is a place called Lux Lounge, which I doubt exists. The minute that he gives this bit of information, that sets into motion the MetaFilter detectives, and we'll see what happens here just in a second. Someone else chimes in with an offer of a place to stay in Washington, D.C., and then user Schmod comes in and says, okay, this is the place and links to a Lux Lounge. It's obviously fake or under development. was some sort of Russian restaurant when the Street View car drove through, so they've done a Google map search. A Google search seems to indicate that a variety of restaurants have operated out of the location, the property was listed for sale, and on and on and on. There are other tidbits indicating that it operates as a strip joint. So now we're getting a little bit more details about what these summer jobs are for the Russian students who have come to the U.S. Someone else chimes in that the physical address doesn't check out in Google Street View. And then we have someone comes in with some detailed expertise. To those saying this still might be an honest job offer, I've studied human trafficking and other forms of forced migration under a professor who specializes in researching it. This is quite literally a textbook case of women being trafficked into the sex industry. Traffickers target Russian women. There's always a promised job offer, and it always falls through at the last minute. There's always financial pressure to stay, often to repay loans taken out to finance the trip. The actual job is almost always prostitution, usually forced and unpaid. If there was any hope of this being a legitimate job offer, the employer would be making a much greater effort to distinguish himself in word and in deed from the standard operating procedures of human traffickers. Not interviewing them at midnight in a strip club would be a really good start. So another user chimes in, for future reference in situations exactly like this, please contact the U.S. State Department at jsvisas@state.gov. We, and by that I mean me and my coworkers and I, wow. So here's a Metafilter member who just happens to work for the Department of State. We'll get the situation rectified immediately upon learning of such situations. We cannot take action to ensure that women like Fake's friend here are not exploited unless we know about these situations. Fake comes back, and we're now a few hours into this. A member of the site convinced them to meet her instead of the contact, and this is an interesting comment. I think she is cool, meaning the other member of Metafilter who has offered. So here he's putting a great deal of trust in what many people would refer to as just a bunch of strangers on the internet, right? They'll meet in a few minutes. Somebody else comes back in, wonderful news, and then here's this wonderful offer. Anybody following this who's on the route between Salt Lake City, Vegas, and Southern California, in the meta thread, which has now started up a thread in the gray, there's some effort to find Fake a place to take a break from driving. So we're not only concerned about the Russians who are needing help, we're now taking care of the guy who's posted as well. If anyone in BK, and I'm not even sure, is that Brooklyn, I'm assuming, knows Russian, let me know, and here's a phone number. I have them. Everything's good. This is from, appropriately enough, Internet Fraud Detective Squad Station Number 9 is the username, which there's never been a better username. Catherine Gutierrez-Hines, a 24-year-old psychology student living in Brooklyn. Meanwhile, as that thread's developing, the MetaTalk thread is going on as well, and someone starts a thread to say, this is why I'm proud to call myself a Mephite, and I'll say it the way I say it in my presentation today. Catherine chimes in, okay, I just emailed the police and Jessamine, Cortex, and Matt Howie. They need information from the threads involved. I guess they'll ask you what they need. The cops funded some diner food, so we're good for tonight. Here's my PayPal. Maybe we can feed them and subsidize a trip to the Empire State Building. They were amazed to be at Times Square, and on and on. So here's a quote that I love that kind of epitomizes this idea of gathering space. So tomorrow, if anyone at work asks me what I did last night, I'll say, I didn't do a thing, but a website where I regularly post links about comic books and toy soldiers saved a couple of women from being victims of an international sex trafficking ring. I'm not sure how I'm going to explain that. Ultimately, this story gets written up, gets picked up by Boing Boing, and becomes a much longer article in Mother Jones, and even an article in Newsweek. It's an interview with Catherine Gutierrez-Hines. And then a few weeks later, a follow-up post written by Fake lets everyone know that the girls are okay. They're back in Russia, safe and sound. The community responds with another 254 comments of congratulations and praise. And it's this kind of story that makes Metafilter and MetaTalk such a fascinating venue for research. And that kind of research wouldn't be possible without the cooperation and help of moderators like Josh, who make things like the info dump available to people like us who are interested in looking at this academically. And then, of course, as many of us do as researchers, get wrapped up in the stories and the humanity of the sites and places that we study. I want to close by talking about four paradoxes and how these make Metafilter such a rich venue for research. First, ethos resides in the text, except when it doesn't. Popular depictions of online communities paint them as disembodied spaces where users are known only by their internet nicknames and cartoon avatars, but my study of MetaTalk suggests that contemporary online communities regularly cross into physical space, and that individual ethos is as much a function of one's identity outside the online community as it is a function of one's rhetorical skill within that community. Yes, online Redditors must make greater use of internal or textual ethos to persuade their interlocutors, but they also benefit from a heavy dose of external ethos in the form of appeals to their professional credentials, their past actions on the website, and their offline relationships with community members. Likewise, when members of online communities assess the ethos of their interlocutors, they take into account both internal and external factors. They're impressed by a fellow community member's articulate arguments, but they also consider who that member is outside the online community. Thus, Aristotelian ethos and the notion of the weird bonus work hand in hand for digital Redditors and their audiences. Second, collective ethos is the work of a few. As a longtime reader and lurker on MetaFilter, I knew that not all members of the community participated in MetaTalk, but I was surprised to discover just how small the core MetaTalk community is. Just a few hundred users account for well over half the comments made on MetaTalk, and yet these discussions set the tone for the rest of the site and help shape the policies that affect nearly, 70,000 members of the community at this point. Members of MetaFilter often criticize one another for their tendency toward introspection, their ability to overthink a plate of beans, in MetaFilter parlance, but the constant self-analysis and community monitoring that occurs on MetaTalk keeps the larger community in check, even if the participants of that larger community don't realize it. As contributors of MetaTalk praise one another, accuse one another, question the moderators, and plan offline gatherings, they strengthen MetaFilter's collective ethos and solidify their identities as loyal members of that community. Third, the best dictators have no rules. The owner of MetaFilter, Matt Howey, is often described by members of the community as a benevolent dictator with a laissez-faire ethic, and when asked, he himself described his leadership style as, quote, a loosey-goosey guideline approach. That's actually in the dissertation. In an essay about running online communities, he advises managers of other communities to avoid making hard and fast rules for governing behavior. He says, don't bother trying to come up with 100 bullet points of things you can and can't do, because once you go down the path of even a few rules, you soon find yourself at the top of a heap of laws that constantly have to be added to in order to please your most argumentative members, while at the same time having those rules hold you back and force you to bring the hammer down on people that accidentally crossed a line. The practice of using guidelines rather than rules has undoubtedly created more work for Howie and Josh and Jessamine and other moderators, since each dispute must be settled on its own merits and each request must be evaluated individually. At the same time, this case-by-case approach allows the moderators to be both human and humane. And finally, serious communities are powered by silliness. During my years as a dedicated lurker on MetaTalk, I was often impressed by how effectively members of the community argued with one another. As a student of online communication, I saw highly nuanced conversations that were ripe for rhetorical analysis, and as a teacher of writing, I saw models that I wanted my students to emulate as they learned to communicate in digital spaces. The moment I donned my researcher's hat, however, the sophisticated conversations seemed to evaporate. In their place, I saw mostly immature jokes, ceaseless puns, and frequent name-calling. What had happened to my perfect research site? The answer, of course, is that the jokes had been there all along. As a member of the community, I had simply stopped noting the ludic or playful discourse that surrounded the serious work of the community. Ludic discourse exists in all communities. Consider the essential functions served by water cooler talk in many workplaces, but it's especially prevalent in online communities. Albert Ruzzi explains ludic discourse allows meta-communication unattainable through the merely serious. Interlocutors online depend on play as the means by which relationships are formed and lubricated, and this affects how they work together, learn from one another, and mutually reform their subject positions. All of this goes back to me, to our good friend Howard Rheingold, who coined the term the virtual community and wrote the book back in 1993, where he describes virtual communities as social aggregations that emerge from the internet when enough people carry on those public discussions long enough, and the key for me is with sufficient human feeling to form webs of personal relationship in cyberspace. Why does all this matter? Well, I'm guessing that we spend a lot of time here, as do our students. As more of us regularly participate in online communities and educate the next generation of online denizens, we need strategies for developing our individual ethos in digital texts, evaluating the ethos of those we encounter online, and contributing to the collective ethos of the communities to which we belong. Thank you.